debate. Rami Kovatov, my entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens, and whatever is in the earth, is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him, but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. The headlines: the Yemeni army conducts two drone attacks on Saudi Arabia a day after striking an Aramco facility in Jeddah with a missile. A coalition of rights groups call on the new U.S. administration to address a dramatic deterioration in Bahrain's rights record. Also ahead, China says it will confront any foreign interference in Hong Kong and deter any separatist activity in Taiwan. Welcome to World News. It's good to have you with us. The Yemeni army says it has carried out retaliatory drone strikes against targets at Saudi Arabia's King Khalid Air Base and Abha International Airport. The Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sari' said the attacks conducted by Samad 3 and Qasif 2K drones were in response to Saudi Arabia's escalation of aggression and the continued siege of Yemen. The strikes came a day after a similar attack on King Khalid Air Base. Also on Thursday, the Yemeni army launched a missile attack against an Aramco oil facility in Saudi Arabia. Our correspondent in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a Abdul Latif al-Washali, says Yemen will continue its attacks on Saudi positions in response to the kingdom's war on the country.
The Yemeni army have warned earlier that it will continue escalating its attacks, retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia, and they will maybe in the next days will be much harder for Saudi Arabia due to the continued detention of oil vessels. Yemenis have a severe fuel crisis. Since the beginning of 2021, not even a liter of oil derivatives was allowed to enter the country. So the equation, I think, will be their oil in exchange of the Yemenis' oil. The Yemeni army will continue its escalation on the ground. It will continue advancing toward Marib. I think the battle fronts in Marib are also another pressure in the Saudi Arabia. So the Yemeni army will continue its attacks, whether they were on the Saudi facilities or on the ground.
Meanwhile, a mortar attack by Saudi-backed mercenaries has killed two infants in Yemen's Taiz province. Several people were also injured in the attack that hit a residential area. Loyalists of Saudi-backed former Yemeni regime often conduct attacks on areas under the control of Ansar Allah movement and its allies. Such attacks have taken place amid Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. Riyadh began its war with the stated goal of toppling Ansar Allah. On the ground, however, civilians have borne the brunt of the conflict. The United Nations says nearly 250,000 Yemenis have died so far, more than a half of them from indirect causes such as a lack of food. A coalition of human rights groups has urged the United States to address what they call a dramatic deterioration in Bahrain's rights record. 15 groups, including Amnesty International and the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, made the call in a letter to the U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken. They said Bahrain, emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's disregard for human rights, has intensified the crackdown on dissent to an unprecedented level. Manama has responded to a popular uprising that began in 2011 with an iron fist. The Al Khalifa regime has detained rights campaigners, broken up major opposition political parties, and revoked the nationality of several pro-democracy activists. The regime has also arrested, injured, and killed thousands of people. Rights activist Firas Najim says things have only become worse for the Bahraini people during the years as the Al Khalifa regime ruthlessly crushes dissidents.
Pretty much now they feel like they're successful because the people there are not really rising up anymore that much, and the movement hasn't reignited again, because I guess the people don't want their family members to be attacked, because we've seen the Bahrain regime has no mercy. They attack women, they rape women, they attack kids, they go in houses at nighttime and they hit with tear gas and the automatic weapons. They have mercenaries from different countries that are hired, that are given citizenships as well. I mean, so I don't see any positive changes from the Bahrain regime at all. I mean, the people are more quiet, not because they don't want to stand up. It's just because they are trying to keep their families out of the suffering and misery. And that's the reason. The Bahrainis, they want change still. They haven't gave up, and they're not submissive as well. That inside of them, they are just, really wounded, and they want to do something, but they're trying to wait for the right time maybe to reignite, and hopefully that will happen if nothing is done by, human rights organizations, the United Nations, and, all these international key players.
Okay, moving to other news now. The U.S. administration has underlined its opposition to the International Criminal Court's decision to open a formal investigation into Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. The stance was highlighted in a phone call between U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Harris also underscored the, quote, unwavering U.S. commitment to Israel. The ICC launched its probe into Israeli war crimes after ruling that it has jurisdiction over occupied Palestinian territories. The move has been welcomed by human rights organizations, including Amnesty International. The focus of the inquiry will be the Israeli military offensive during the 2014 war on Gaza, as well as the regime's settlement activities in the occupied West Bank.
Palestinian human rights organizations, including Al-Haq, Al-Mizan, Al-Damir, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, have welcomed the International Criminal Court ICC decision on the opening of a full criminal investigation into the situation in Palestine. On Wednesday, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Fatou Bensouda, announced the decision to launch a formal inquiry into alleged crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. For decades, Tel Aviv has demonstrated zero accountability to crimes perpetrated by its soldiers. Israeli forces have killed and maimed thousands of innocent Palestinians and waged three wars on the Gaza Strip since 2008.
Sayyida bin Suda.
We have been looking forward to bin Suda's decision to launch a formal inquiry to probe war crimes by Israeli leaders. We have worked hard to reach this point, and for us the decision is a historic moment for Palestine and for the victims of Israeli crimes.
Last month, the International Criminal Court affirmed that the court has full territorial jurisdiction over the occupied Palestinian territories. Israeli crimes against Palestinians have been systematic and taking place on a daily basis. Victims of Israeli crimes have also welcomed the ICC decision.
My children were sleeping when Israeli warplanes bombed our house. 11 members of my family were buried under the rubble and 5 of them were killed. I want justice for my children.
The ICC decision is a victory for the Palestinian people. We welcome this move to probe Israeli war crimes because Israeli forces killed innocent civilians with cold blood.
The chief prosecutor will also investigate the Israeli military's use of deadly force against Palestinian protesters during the Great March of Return peaceful rallies in Gaza.
We hope that the ICC probe will finally bring justice to the victims of Israeli war crimes. Israel has been perpetrating war crimes against the Palestinian people for decades. With this ICC decision, we are entering a new era, and we hope that justice will finally prevail.
The Israeli regime has consistently failed to make any attempt to hold individuals at any level responsible for war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Rights groups say the International Criminal Court must take concrete steps in order to end Tel Aviv's impunity and bring Israeli leaders to justice. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
China says it will resolutely guard against and deter any interference by external forces in Hong Kong's affairs. Prime Minister Li Keqiang made the remark at the annual session of the National People's Congress. Li said China will implement law and enforce mechanisms for Hong Kong to ensure national security. The premier, at the same time, reaffirmed Beijing's commitment to fully support the one country, two systems policy towards Hong Kong. On Taiwan, the Chinese prime minister said his country will resolutely deter any separatist activity aimed at independence. Li also said Beijing wants to promote peaceful ties with the island, but only under its One China principle. The policy asserts that Taiwan is part of mainland China. Stephen Rebay in Beijing says China believes that Hong Kong has become a base of subversion supported by foreign forces.
From China's point of view, Hong Kong had become a base of subversion to central power. And a lot of that subversion was being assisted and aided by foreign powers. Well, there's only one that really matters, and that's the United States. So China has moved over the past year to really stop that. Last year, it passed the national security law, which made it illegal to collude with foreign powers or engage in subversive activities, or what it terms as terrorist, which could be interpreted as any kind of violent or even too agitated demonstration. And now it's moving further to reform Hong Kong's electoral system.
In other news, Brazil's daily coronavirus infections rise by more than 75,000, a new high since July last year. The total COVID-19 cases have reached nearly 10.8 million. The Latin American country also recorded nearly 1,700 new fatalities, bringing the overall death toll to almost 261,000. That's while health authorities have warned that the emergence of new variants could worsen the situation, as the country's vaccination program has been sluggish. Brazil has recorded the world's second highest virus-related deaths after the United States. The total number of fatalities in the US, the world's worst hit country, has surpassed 520,000, with over 28.8 million positive cases. A new report suggests that poverty in Italy was dramatically on the rise last year. The report also said the COVID-19 crisis has exposed the vulnerability of the new poor in Italy. Max Civilli has the details.
Data released by the National Bureau of Statistics ISTAT shows that absolute poverty levels in Italy reached a 15-year high in 2020, Last year, the number of families facing absolute poverty climbed to 7.7% from 6.4% in 2019, translating into more than 2 million households not being able to afford the minimum standards of living, which include food, adequate shelter, and health care.
We had more than 1 million additional poor in 2020 compared to the year before. However, it must be said that growing poverty levels have also been recorded across all European countries and in the UK after the 2008 financial crisis. Italy has struggled to pick up from that downturn due to a fragmentation of anti-poverty policies and ineffective employment strategies.
Statistical body Istat also stressed that the monthly spending of the average Italian household dropped by almost 10%. Sent to about €2,300 last year, the lowest value since 2000.
Those without solid job contracts are the most exposed in the COVID-19 crisis that has already killed almost 100,000 people in Italy, the second highest death toll in Europe. Food security is emerging as a key issue for an increasing number of Italians.
The cost of living has risen to unbearable levels. My son used to work as a temporary employee in a restaurant. He has been jobless for months now. How long can we carry on this way?
The previous government hasn't helped Italy much. My daughter has been temporarily laid off, and her pay is now one-third of what it used to be.
Discontent among Italians is also growing over a much delayed vaccination campaign. So far, 1.5 million people, about 3% of the population only, have been inoculated with both COVID vaccine doses amid delays and disputes in the delivery schedule across the whole of the European Union. Max Civili, Rome.
The US Capitol Police have demanded that National Guard troops remain at the Capitol amid warnings of a possible attack there. The department's acting chief made the appeal in a letter to congressional leaders. Yogananda Pittman called on them to use their influence to keep the guardsmen at the Capitol. She said the board that oversees her department has declined to extend an emergency declaration to keep the guardsmen. She said the board has instead sent her a list of actions, including partial removal of guarding fences. The U.S. Capitol is on high alert over warnings of a possible attack by a militia group that supports former President Donald Trump. In early January, Trump supporters stormed the building, leaving five people dead. Staying in the United States, where resentment is high after President Joe Biden backtracked on his promise to raise the minimum wage to $15 per hour. However, studies have shown that considering the constant inflation in the country, even $15 per hour would not constitute a living wage for single adult households in any state. Ramin Mazahari is in Chicago.
In his very first campaign speech to win the presidential election, Joe Biden promised to more than double the federal minimum wage from just over $7 an hour to a minimum of $15 per hour. However, the ruling Democratic Party has retracted the wage increase from the third fiscal stimulus negotiations, disappointing 30 million low-wage workers in the middle of a once-in-a-century economic crisis. There is a whopping 75% public approval rating for Biden's stimulus program, but those polls came out before many of the details were released. Biden has since pulled support for many of the economic promises he made during his election campaign. After just 1 month in office, Biden has so far backtracked on his promises for major student debt relief, the amount of and length of unemployment payments, the total amount of household stimulus checks, and he has made no mention of reversing Donald Trump's signature tax cuts for the rich, something that Biden promised to initiate on his very first day in office.
It really shows the bankruptcy of every 4 years, this incrementalism where the left in the United States is pressured into getting behind the Democratic candidate, not going third party. Why? Because, oh, well, we're going to get these small concessions, like something like, hey, a $15 minimum wage increase or student loan debt, things like that.
However, countless economists insist that a wage increase would stimulate the economy overall by giving workers more money to spend, thus creating jobs and badly needed growth.
By doing that, by saying that, you know, it's impacting small businesses, what they're effectively doing is taking the economic burden that's put on small businesses by corporations, which own and control the politicians in Washington, they're shifting that burden onto workers and making workers pay the price.
The so-called fight for $15 began shortly after 2009, which is the last year the federal minimum wage was increased. But a decade later, studies show that constant inflation means that $15 per hour in 2021 would not constitute a living wage for a single adult household in any state. The study said in the cheapest metropolitan areas, $20 per hour is now required, while major cities would need $25 per hour. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Now, UN human rights experts have warned that U.S. emergency declarations authorizing unilateral sanctions are leading to serious human rights violations. The experts said the bans violate a wide range of human rights, not only in targeted countries such as Iran, China, Russia, Syria, and Venezuela, but also elsewhere across the world. They added that coercive measures breach rights to freedom of movement and association, as well as economic and social rights, and the very right to life. The UN experts stressed that U.S. emergencies often last years or even decades, and so do the sanctions they authorize. They noted that the declarations appear to be excuses to impose the measures indefinitely instead of being true emergencies. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
MIT Assistant Professor Kevin Yufeng Chen says, if we look at most drones today, they're usually quite big, adding, most of their applications involve flying outdoors. The question is, can you create insect-scale robots that can move around in very complex, cluttered spaces? We're prepared for you an article written by Daniel Ackerman, a researcher at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. The piece is titled, Insect-Inspired Flying Robots, Researchers Introduce a New Generation of Tiny Agile Drones. The article has been taken from the SciTechDaily.com website. Please stay with us to hear more of Daniel Ackerman's article. The technology could boost aerial robots' repertoire, allowing them to operate in cramped spaces and withstand collisions. If you ever swatted a mosquito away from your face only to have it return again and again and again, you know that insects can be remarkably acrobatic and resilient in flight. Those traits help them navigate the aerial world with all of its wind, gusts, obstacles, general uncertainty. Such traits are also hard to build into flying robots, but MIT assistant professor Kevin Yufeng Chen has built a system that approaches insects' agility. Chen, a member of the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science and a research laboratory of electronics, has developed insect-sized drones with unprecedented dexterity and resilience. The aerial robots are powered by a new class of soft actuator, which allows them to withstand the physical travails of real-world flight. Chen hopes the robots could one day aid humans by pollinating crops or performing machinery inspections in cramped spaces. Professor Chen's work appears this month in the journal IEEE Transactions on Robotics. His co-authors include MIT PhD student Zhijian Ren, Harvard University PhD student Si Zhu, and City University of Hong Kong roboticist Pakpong Chiraratananun. Typically, drones require wide open spaces because they're neither nimble enough to navigate confined spaces nor robust enough to withstand collisions in a crowd. Professor Chen says, if we look at most drones today, they're usually quite big, adding, most of their applications involve flying outdoors. The question is, can you create insect-scale robots that can move around in very complex, cluttered spaces? According to Chen, the challenge of building small aerial robots is immense. Pint-sized drones require a fundamentally different construction from larger ones. Large drones are usually powered by motors, but motors lose efficiency as you shrink them. So, Professor Chen says, for insect-like robots, you need to look for alternatives. The principal alternative until now has been employing a small rigid actuator built from piezoelectric ceramic materials. While piezoelectric ceramics allowed the first generation of tiny robots to take flight, they're quite fragile, and that's a problem when you're building a robot to mimic an insect. Foraging bumblebees endure a collision about once every second. Professor Chen designed a more resilient tiny drone using soft actuators instead of hard, fragile ones. The soft actuators are made of thin rubber cylinders coated in carbon nanotubes. When voltage is applied to the carbon nanotubes, they produce an electrostatic force that squeezes and elongates the rubber cylinder. Repeated elongation and contraction causes the drone's wings to beat fast. MIT professor Kevin Yufeng Chen's actuators can flap nearly 500 times per second, giving the drone insect-like resilience. Chen says you can hit it when it's flying and it can recover, adding, it can also do aggressive maneuvers like somersaults in the air, and it weighs in at just 0.6 grams, approximately the mass of a large bumblebee. The drone looks a bit like a tiny cassette tape with wings, though Chen is working on a new prototype shaped like a dragonfly. Farrell Helbling, an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at Cornell University, who was not involved in the research, says, Achieving flight with a centimeter-scale robot is always an impressive feat, adding, because of the soft actuator's inherent compliance, the robot can safely run into obstacles without greatly inhibiting flight. This feature is well suited for flight in cluttered, dynamic environments and could be very useful for any number of real-world applications. Farrell Helbling added, a key step towards those applications will be untethering the robots from a wired power source, which is currently required by the actuator's high operating voltage. Helbling notes, I'm excited to see how the authors will reduce operating voltage so that they may one day be able to achieve untethered flight in real-world environments. Building insect-like robots can provide a window into the biology and physics of insect flight, a long-standing avenue of inquiry for researchers. Professor Chen's work addresses these questions through a kind of reverse engineering. He says, if you want to learn how insects fly, it is very instructive to build a scale robot model, adding, you can perturb a few things and see how it affects the kinematics or how the fluid forces change. That will help you understand how those things fly. But Professor Chen aims to do more than add to entomology textbooks. His drones can be useful in industry and agriculture. Professor Chen says his mini aerialists could navigate complex machinery to ensure safety and functionality, adding, think about the inspection of a turbine engine. You'd want a drone to move around an enclosed space with a small camera to check for cracks under turbine plates. Other potential applications include artificial pollination of crops or completing search and rescue missions following a disaster. Professor Chen says all those things can be very challenging for existing large-scale robots. Sometimes bigger isn't better.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
And on day 36 of his term, U.S. President Joe Biden dropped his first ever bomb on Syria. It must have been such a proud moment for his so very diverse cabinet, especially for Kamala Harris, the first woman vice president of color to drop a bomb on a sovereign nation. Because why on earth not? Diplomacy is back, President Joe Biden declared at the Munich Security Conference last week. But so is bombing Syria, apparently. Biden has only been president a bit more than a month, but he has already ordered his first bombing campaign. Mind you, it took Trump 4 months to do the same. The target was a military checkpoint in eastern Syria used by the Syrian Arab Army and their allies, the Iraqi PMU, to secure the borders from Daesh attacks. But why use U.S. war jets and U.S.-made bombs to obliterate the actual Daesh terrorists when you can't eliminate the only force capable of defeating Daesh? Presumably, Biden wanted to signal to Iran, as the JCPOA diplomacy window was about to be opened, that it would pay a heavy price if it keeps up its support for the regional resistance. But by bombing Syria for this reason, Biden proved how failing to rejoin the nuclear agreement endangers U.S. interests in the region while Iran's nuclear program continues to advance. What Biden did was not shifting to diplomacy in any way. Rather, he kept up the empire's risky warmongering rhetoric, making the U.S. and Iran glide closer to a military confrontation. While Biden campaigned on a commitment to return to his JCPOA, his attempt to play hardball with Iran and his airstrikes against Syria and his refusal to remove suffocating sanctions on Iran signaled a foreign policy intent on continuing U.S. imperialism in West Asia. The U.S. airstrikes also signaled the Biden administration's support for the Israeli regime, which had its own array of airstrikes along the Syria-Iraq border over the years. Biden, of course, is no stranger to the use of airstrikes. As vice president, he was complicit in the Obama administration's attempts to institute regime change all across the region, infamously bombing seven different countries at one time. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In his first military action since inauguration, Joe Biden launched a series of airstrikes against Syria, signaling a renewed imperialist offensive in the region. This serves as a reminder for the victims of U.S. imperialism abroad that there is no lesser evil when it comes to the U.S. It is simply back to normal for the U.S. as Biden and his Vice President Kamala Harris are only escalating the wars started by former President Barack Obama. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Sharmeen Narwani, political commentator and journalist. Thank you for being with us, Sharmeen. Now, Biden thought that he was giving the world some sort of a glimpse of how is he likely going to approach one of the greatest security concerns for the United States of America and the American puppet regimes, if I may, in the region, which is the network of resistance factions, by targeting Kata'ef Hezbollah, which are part of the popular mobilization forces on the Syrian-Iraqi border, which they are there to begin with to prevent Daesh from roaming in these areas. How do you think this stunt will play out on both sides, both in Syria and in Iraq, where the U.S. occupation troops are still residing?
Well, not very well at all. In fact, very badly. I mean, let's not forget these countries are divided in terms of those who support Iran or who support Iraqi sovereignty, nationalists, etc., and then those who are pro-America, which I believe are a minority in both countries. And so, you know, we have to realize that when the Americans launch airstrikes like this, they're doing so for specific reasons. One is to play to their domestic constituents, you know, the media, the pundit class, their constituents also go outside that. They're playing to their NATO partners. Biden's showing the world, he's showing his NATO partners that that the U.S. is back and in play under a Biden administration, and also the Saudis and Israelis and Emiratis, who have invested a lot in the U.S. military-industrial complex. So, number one, the U.S. plays to its constituencies, you know. Number two, the U.S. is marking its territory like a dog would, you know, that Iraq is still very much in play, okay, and we're the boss man here. And I think the third thing is to maybe deter foes. And this is where they always fail, because both in Iraq and Syria, we have seen a great deal of efficiency on the armed forces and militias that are fighting ISIS and who are opposed to U.S.'s forces, U.S. forces remaining in this, those countries. So I think, you know, the foes actually in this case, they gain more resolve. But I want to point out something that, you know, here's Biden doing a strike that really, you know, it killed one person, sadly, a Hashishabi fighter who was fighting ISIS, obviously patrolling on the border. But as much as the Americans try to impose their narratives on the world, you know, we're still boss, we still can play in your territorial, you know, ground. The Americans may dominate narratives, but as I say time and time again, is we now control the outcomes in the region. So, in fact, Biden is giving his foes more resolve, and I believe we will see more action, more coordination to expel U.S. troops, which was, in fact, what the Iraqi parliament voted for a year ago.
Well, Charmaine, we had Kata'ib Hezbollah officially describing the martyr fighter as a member of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces, which is a collection of resistance groups, if people still don't know, that includes Kata'ib Hezbollah and are officially part of the Iraqi Armed Forces as per a bill passed by the parliament back in 2017. Yet 4 days prior to the attack of the U.S. on these fighters, Prime Minister Qadhimi tweeted about reaffirming his commitment with the U.S. in what is now being seen as a green light to target those fighters. How will that be translated inside of Iraq's internal political arena?
Well, terrible, because, you know, the Iraqi population is already pretty polarized on many, many issues. And, you know, none of them want the U.S. to use Iraqi territory as a battleground to fight its little internal battle with Iran. So I think you are going to have more polarization. I think Prime Minister Kadhimi was very, very foolish to openly, you know, by the way, he tweeted right after he'd had a call with U.S. President Joe Biden. So, you know, to say that you were committed to improving on and bolstering the U.S.-Iraqi relationship in the fight against ISIS and for the benefit of the Iraqi people, a year after the U.S. Violated international law and launched an attack against an Iranian general and a senior member of the Iraqi army and the deputy commander, Hashishabi, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. And then to completely ignore that the U.S., the Iraqi parliament voted to expel foreign forces is a very foolish move by Kadhimi, because he has put himself very squarely in the sort of pro-U.S. camp right now. I think, you know, it's important for Kadhimi and others to understand something. The ones who are not so opposed to the U.S. Are, you know, they talk often about they need to strike a balance between their U.S. and their Iran policy, which is fair enough. You know, Iraq is a sovereign country. It has the right to act in its own self-interest. And it doesn't want to be dominated by a neighbor next door. It doesn't want to be dominated by the world's military power, right? So, but in order to have a balance and to have a fair playing field so neither Iran or the U.S. has an advantage, U.S. forces have to leave Iraqi territory. There are no Iranian forces on Iraqi territory. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? If U.S. policy has been conducted out of Washington, Iran policy has been conducted out of Tehran, and they both have their proponents in Iraq, that's a fair playing field, and that gives Iraq the breathing space to act as a sovereign nation.
Well, Charmaine, we heard Syria's foreign ministry saying that the Arab country strongly condemns the American act of aggression on its soil, claiming that it will not undermine the Syrian commitment along with its allies to drive the American occupation out of the Syrian soil. Does this like signal some sort of a possible targeting of U.S. occupation facilities inside Syria, similar to what is now happening in Iraq as well?
You know, sadly, I don't think so. I think that we know well that the Syrians have been using this language in opposition to the continual occupation of their territory by both U.S. forces and Turkish forces. So I'm not, I do not believe the Syrian government can act against U.S. forces, because then, the U.S. establishment and the pundit class will use that as an opportunity to launch attacks against the Syrian state and the Syrian mm-hmm. government, maybe the Syrian army. So I don't think the Syrians will launch direct attacks against U.S. interests inside Syria. I think the way to do this, to get U.S. forces out of Syria, frankly, is to expel them from Iraq. Because U.S. forces in the northeast of Syria and the southeast of Syria will no longer have, nobody will have their backs any longer. They will essentially be territorially isolated, okay, and landlocked. So there are few Syrian forces in Iraq, much, less than in Syria. There are few U.S. forces in Syria, much less than in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And in Iraq, the U.S. has a lot of ability to move around, flexibility to move around. If those forces are expelled, not just from Iraq, but particularly around the border areas, from north to south of the Syrian border, the U.S. forces in Syria will no longer have the cover, and they will lead that way. And so I think really now you have to have a prime minister in Iraq who has the guts to align with the leadership in Syria to have a joint commitment to the removal of foreign forces from their territories.
Well, I really wanted to talk more about how the U.S. media is calling this asserting U.S. leadership, but unfortunately we're out of time. I want to thank you very much, Sharmeen Irwani, political commentator and journalist, for joining us from Beirut to talk about, after 37 days, how Biden decided to bomb Syria. That's not a surprise, but it happened. Thank you very much. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about how Yemen is fighting for its life as the U.S. plays a charade for all the world to watch.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, in the dying days of Donald Trump's presidency, former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced his imprudent decision to designate the Yemeni Ansarullah Resistance Movement as a terrorist organization. Shortly after, Biden's Secretary of State Antony Blinken reversed Pompeo's decisions vis-à-vis Ansarullah, allegedly to avoid obstructing the delivery of food and medicine to the Yemeni civilians who are being starved to death in the Saudi-orchestrated genocide. The U.S.'s humanitarian charade in Yemen in this following report.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken revoked on February 16 designations of Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization and a specially designated global terrorist group. The decision reversing the former Trump administration's blacklisting of the Yemeni resistance is part of a policy shift by U.S. President Joe Biden, allegedly aimed at easing the world's worst humanitarian crisis and intensifying diplomacy to end the Saudi aggression on Yemen. The United Nations and aid organizations had shared fears that the sanctions imposed on Ansarullah under the designations could strangle food deliveries just as the threat of major famine is rising. Blinken, however, did not take too long to signal limits to U.S. tolerance of the Ansarullah movement, reiterating that three of its leaders, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, Abdul Khaliq Badr al-Houthi, and Abdullah Yahya al-Hakim, will remain subject to U.S. sanctions. Meanwhile, as the U.S. continued with its humanitarian charade, heavy airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition ripped through the Yemeni city of Hudaydah, obliterating an entire family of five, including children, on Saturday, in what is now the daily lives of Yemenis for the past 6 years, which would have never happened without an American green light. It is because of this American-Saudi genocide the Yemenis firmly believe that the reasons behind Biden's decision to revoke Ansarullah terrorist designation is not the moral guilt and sense of complicity
complicity of American leaders in Washington or American apathetic public opinion. Rather, it is an assiduous effort to extricate the United States' closest ally in West Asia, Saudi Arabia, from the Yemeni quagmire. This is also evident in the current Battle of Ma'rib that Ansarullah are winning on a fast pace, in which the U.S. installed military experts to lead the Saudi battle in Ma'rib. Ansarullah sent out a clear message by their spokesperson, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, for that specific matter, telling Biden that if he really wants peace, he must withdraw his experts and push the British to stop arming the planes targeting the resistance all across Yemen. Ma'rib was never a quiet front, yet the Security Council felt silent all these years and then woke up just now to call for an end of fighting when Ansarullah are only a few kilometers away from liberating the entire governorate from the U.S.-enabled Saudi occupation.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maarouf, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Laith. Now, heavy airstrikes by Saudi-led coalition have been ripping through the Yemeni cities, especially the major ones, all throughout the past 6 years. While the American officials, doesn't matter whether they were Democrats or Republicans, they never raised a red flag to stop it. But now, Ansarullah is being delisted from the foreign terrorist organizations by the new Biden administration. Do you think that this act will ensue a change to the American pro-Saudi approach against Yemen?
Well, remember, the designation of terrorist organization for Ansarullah happened just at the end of the Trump regime era. And so it was kind of a parting gift between Trump and MBS. And right now, Biden is returning to the usual. You know, for 5 years, the United States, prior to designating the Houthis, Ansarullah, as a terrorist organization, they were helping the Saudi Arabia bomb the hell out of Yemen. It didn't matter that they were not listed as such. So really, it's just taking off this basic designation and returning to the usual genocidal colonialism of the United States and Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
Well, Laith, they were embroiled. The Yemenis were embroiled by years long of genocide inflicted by the American Saudi Israeli coalition. I think that's why they believe that the Biden delisting and revoking Ansarullah's terrorist designation is not out of moral guilt from Biden or the sense of maybe a complicity by the American leaders in Washington. Rather, it's some sort of a tireless effort to extricate the United States' biggest ally in the region, and that's Saudi Arabia, from the Yemeni quagmire. Is that why Biden is at odds with Mohammed bin Salman? He wants to stop the war, Mohammed bin Salman doesn't?
Well, it's more like, you know, Biden wants to shake down Saudi Arabia, just like Trump did, but in a different way. So we have to think about the same announcement of about the assassination of Khashoggi at the Saudi embassy in Turkey that just happened by the United States. It's not really to condemn them or Saudi Arabia or isolate MBS. It's to shake him down for more money. And in this situation for Yemen, what is clear is that the United States image is getting tarnished by association. Everybody is watching what's happening in Yemen. Everybody in the world knows it's the worst humanitarian starvation situation on the whole planet, and thanks to Saudi Arabia and its masters in the UK, Israel, and the United States. So that's really only a cosmetic change. What will make a difference, and what is making a difference on the ground, is the resistance of the Yemeni people who are defeating all the tools of the empire.
Well, the flood of U.S. weaponry and arms to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has definitely helped the Saudi despotic regime to kill thousands of Yemenis, including children of Yemen, on school buses and families trying to flee the violence by Saudi Arabia. Biden says that he stopped the arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and yet just a week after he said that, we saw SAM, the Saudi Defense Ministry, signing new contracts with Lockheed Martin to transfer technology, knowledge, and training to Saudi nationals to manufacture products and produce services to the kingdom's armed forces. What now? Is it like, we're not going to sell you the guns, but we're going to teach you how to make them yourselves?
part of it is that, and the other part is all the other provinces and protectorates of the United States, meaning Canada, for instance, are going to ratchet up the sale of their weapons while the United States pretends that it's cutting down on sales to weapons. And in the case of the situation of transfer of knowledge and technologies, do you really think that there will be Saudi scientists and workers that are building these weapons? And they're going to basically purchase a whole factories, transfer them into Saudi Arabia, and bring with them the workers on to do the work in Saudi Arabia. So really, this is, again, just trying to camouflage the continued support for the genocide in Yemen.
Well, that definitely is some sort of an ironic issue, but at the same time, it would be very sad if that happens and the war is still going on. But Saudi Arabia claimed on Saturday that it had intercepted a missile attack coming from the Yemeni side over the capital, Riyadh, and that's not the first time. The latest in a series of airborne attacks claimed by the Ansarullah resistance movement in Yemen. All the while, we are watching Yemen, the battlefield in Yemen, the front lines are falling apart, the Saudi front lines, and Ansarullah are advancing really fast there. But at the same time, Mohammed bin Salman continues to bomb